Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming along to this session. I'm really pleased to see so many people here and interested in hearing about these professional standards, particularly just before Christmas, that you're still excited about these kind of technical issues. Ben and I will be covering them, obviously, in Sydney today, and two of our colleagues will cover this same topic in Melbourne in a couple of days' time. Don't press end, press start. Okay. So today, I mean, you're all very familiar, I'm sure, with the history of all this, through Cooper and Stronger Super from a couple of years ago, to a discussion paper issued on the standards a bit over a year ago, to the draft standards earlier this year, and finally these 12 final standards. A couple of them are proposed final, but that's only because enabling legislation didn't quite make it through last Thursday. But we've pretty much got 12 final standards now. These standards, though, will be followed up by some prudential practice guides. Some apparently due next week, and the rest sometime in the first quarter of next year. I suspect the ones that we're going to talk about today will be covered by prudential practice guides that will follow next year rather than before Christmas, but we might get an unpleasant surprise if you've got to study them, I guess. Okay, I've hit end again. I'll get that. So today, I'll cover basically the first three, and Ben will cover the second three. The purpose mainly today, of course, is to, I guess, give you a bit of a flavour of what's in them, but I'm not really attempting to go through them all and give you chapter and verse. I mean, you can read the standards. They're not that hard to read. But I will try and point out where, Ben and I will try and point out where there were some changes made. And also, of course, get your feedback. I mean, we're happy to take questions as we go through. And to do so, if you're going to ask a question, I need you to speak into one of these microphones, because this is being recorded, of course, so that we can get the right transcript happening. So, as I say, happy to answer questions as we go through. So, I guess, let me kick off with SPS 160. That tended to be the one where we should requested, I guess, most changes or most feedback we gave to APRA. I think of our 37-page submission, some 22 pages were devoted to SPS 160. So you can see that's one we had, a lot of suggestions on. And we had a couple of good meetings with the people from APRA who were responsible for drafting these standards. And we're pretty pleased that we came together on agreement on, 95% of the suggestions. So in these slides, I'd originally thought I might just go through and mark the changes, but that got a bit tedious with 22 pages of suggestions. So this one is more a summary of the revised standard. A couple of the others we might just cover, some of the changes in particular. So yeah, so in terms of regular actuarial valuations, pretty much the same as is currently the case. Annual evaluations are required for small funds paying DB pensions. For funds with four or more members, annually or as agreed with APRA, and otherwise triennial. And that's basically the same as the current case, except I think if you're a small fund that doesn't have a DB pension, you are required to have annual, and now that's triennial. We had asked, for larger funds with paying DB pensions not to need to go to APRA, but they requested that process of getting approval to, if you're a large fund paying a DB pension, to have a triennial rather than annual valuation, that process will still be required. There was, some clarification that wherever in the prudential standards it says DB funds, it means DB sub-funds. So if you're in a sub-fund, if your client is a sub-fund in a master trust or a multi-employer fund, read these standards as applying to your sub-fund as well as, even though it may say DB fund in the prudential standards. In terms of timing of reports, the initial standard had actuarial reports required within 6 months. And we recognised that was a good objective, although there was always been some practical difficulties with producing valuations more quickly due to data requirements and the like, but it was something that we should move to. And all that we requested really was a transition period to get to it. And the transition period that was requested and is now under prudential standards Still 12 months for any valuations with an effective date up to 30 June next year. But then, as you can see, progressively coming down to 9 months and 6 months over the ensuing 3 years. In terms of your assets, when you look at whether your fund's in an unsatisfactory financial position or in terms of the shortfall limit, your operational risk financial requirement reserve is to be excluded from those assets. So that's excluded first. Net assets after your ORFR reserve is what you can then look at when making an assessment of the financial condition of your financial position of your DB fund or sub-fund. And in the standard, there is a large list of information that must be included in reports, including confirming that three-year projections are mandatory rather than a best practice type requirement. I think the feature that garnered most interest and most comment and I guess most concern with the initial draft was this concept of a shortfall limit. So as it had been quite controversial, the slide actually quotes verbatim the new revised shortfall limit. So a shortfall limit is the extent to which an RSC licensee, the trustee, considers that a fund can be in an unsatisfactory financial position, with the RSC licensee still being able to reasonably expect that because of corrections to temporary negative market fluctuations in the value of fund assets, the fund can be restored to a satisfactory financial position within 1 year. So when you look at that definition, you can sort of pull it apart. There's lots of interesting little words in there. Reasonably expect. What's a temporary negative market fluctuation? The restoration period, actually, within 1 year, the original standard said within 1 year or the next valuation if closer, and that was like, that could be tomorrow, so that's clearly not a good idea, so at least that was removed. I think we expect that in the prudential practice guides that follow, this will be one area in particular where there will be more guidance required. Indeed, if there's not, we actually have a little task force within the SPC just dealing with the shortfall limits in particular, and have been in contact with the appropriate people with APRA to both give our suggestions on what might go into this standard, suggestions on the comment in one of the FAQs on shortfall limits, and we'll be offering further suggestions as to what will be going into the prudential practice guide, and if need be, to issue some guidance to members themselves. So this is one in particular, you know, where I mentioned earlier on today that we'd like your feedback or comments, questions or concerns about, is this concept of a shortfall limit. Reasonably expected, what does that mean? Is that something we should be assigning a probability to? Does it mean a 50% chance, a 90% chance, a 35% chance? How can we get some guidance around what reasonably expect should mean in practice? The concept of a temporary negative market fluctuation. I'm not sure I understand what this term means. I think I can work out if something's temporary in hindsight, but I'm not sure that I can predict in advance that something's going to be temporary. So what is meant by this term? I don't know if anybody in the audience has thought about this definition yet or has any particular concerns with this revised definition of shortfall limits. If you are, I'll shoot a microphone to you. Well, if not, we do want your feedback on this point in particular. So either we can cover this in some general questions and answers at the end of these presentations if you want to think about it for a little bit longer today, or are happy to take them via send me an email. I'll give you my email address later on. Actually, with a bunch of actors, I think you can work out with Brad Jeffrey. It could be brad.jeffrey. And then I come from Towers Watson. It could be at towerswatson.com. So I think you can work that one out. Okay, so this is one we're still concentrating and working on, the shortfall limit. The trustee, of course, has to set it, but of course they're going to turn to their actuary for advice. The shortfall limit, it can be nil, or it can be some other number, but it can't be a number that would actually leave your fund in technical insolvency. So somewhere between naught and the number that it would leave your fund in technical insolvency. So that means it's not covering its minimum requisite benefits. The method of how it's expressed, is it a percentage, is it an index, is it a ratio, is it a dollar amount, that will be specified in the reporting. You know, associated with all of these professional standards, there's reporting requirements, and we need to, I guess, see what the final position is on that reporting format for SPS 160 to know exactly how we express this term, but we can get the concept. Trustees are responsible for having a process to both to set this limit, to determine it, to monitor it, and to report on it. So trustees have to look at this. They have to think about things about how frequently they do this. Is it monthly? Is it quarterly? Is it annually? Is it post a significant market event? As I mentioned, we'll prepare some guidance, unless, of course, it actually comes out in the PPG. So I'm keen to get some more discussion on that, perhaps towards the end or with some feedback afterwards. In terms of interim actuarial evaluations, there were quite a few changes here from the initial draft to the final draft. One of the triggers is that you're performing an initial or a regular or interim investigation. Previously, it did also say or performing a regular or periodic actuarial function as well, but that requirement has been taken out. So we know that this is being tested at the time you're doing evaluation, not just any actuarial function. If the shortfall limit is, or you believe it may be breached, then unless the next investigation is less than 6 months away, or there's already a restoration plan in process, the trustee has to seek the actuary's advice. The requirement about the next actuarial evaluation being within 6 months means you'll be able to bring that forward and kill two birds with one stone, basically, rather than having to do something now and then something in a regular evaluation in less than 6 months' time. For an interim investigation, the report's required within 3 months of the later of the valuation date or the shortfall breach being identified. So at least you've got 3 months from when it's identified, not 3 months from the previous valuation, which means you only found out about it 2 months after that prior date. So we had a lot of concerns about a lot of the timing requirements in the initial draft that were appropriately recognised in our discussions with APRA, and we came up with a more, practical sort of approach to a lot of the requirements for timing. Recognise that when you're doing an interim valuation, you might need to make a reasonable estimate of assets because information is not necessarily readily available when you discover this. If the shortfall limit is breached, the actuary must, within 15 days of making its finding, recommend that action be taken to come up with a contribution program to restore the VBI to 100% within 3 years. So some clarity there around exactly a three-year period. Or if not, within that 15 days, to specify a date by which you will provide that advice. So that was an extra provision introduced into the final standards compared to the draft. Originally, it was just that you actually had only 15 business days to come up with a contribution program, which was felt to be a little bit tight. So you've either got to do it or say when you're going to do it by. Then the trustee has then 3 months to determine, agree, and set out and implement a compliant restoration plan that allows time for consultation with employers and the actuary. The appointment of a responsible actuary. It actually needs to be reappointed. It's not automatically assumed to be your current actuary. And for the actuary to provide advice on whether there's any requirement for benefit payment reductions or deferrals, depending upon the extent of the unsatisfactory financial position and taking into account, of course, the need to balance equity between departing members and remaining members. There are details on the trustee's restoration plan. So this restoration plan must outline likely contributions that will be paid as recommended, any changes to be made to the investment strategy, the likely impact on benefit payments during the restoration plan, and a monitoring and review process. So this trustee's plan, and of course they'll be relying on the actuary to contribute mostly to the requirements. It has, again, a quite detailed list of things that need to be done that are set out in the prudential standard. APRA, of course, must be informed about them and may request changes, or indeed require changes, or impose additional reporting requirements while that restoration plan is in place. And if progress is unsatisfactory, APRA may allow a variation in the funding and in the funding period over which the fund needs to get back to a satisfactory financial position, or ask the trustee to take further guidance. And there'll be some transitional arrangements if it is an unsatisfactory financial position when these new standards start on 1 July. These standards are proposed to start on 1 July next year. Also covers self-insurance, which of course now is to be restricted to members with defined benefit interests within a fund or sub-fund that currently self-insures and is allowed to self-insure. The main change here was that the requirement in the initial proposed standard was that the trustee must maintain reserves to fund any self-insured liabilities. That's been broadened a bit to maintain reserves or other arrangements approved by APRA, so you may go to APRA if you have other arrangements in place. It was, I guess, in our initial submission, our thought was that DB funds are used to managing reserves, differences between assets and liabilities, and there wasn't need for a specifically identified self-insurance reserve. So that possibly will still be the case, but you'll need to have APRA approve that arrangement as to whether you maintain a specific reserve or it's covered in your general funding approach and to the fund. Other than that, the other provisions were as per the initial draft, so the requirement to ensure actuarial oversight of the self-insurance and obtain an actuarial assessment at least every 3 years, annually to attest that the self-insurance continues to be in a member's best interests. I think that's a requirement on the trustee rather than the actuary, so the trustee has that nice duty to work out whether self-insurance is in a member's best interest. That's something that the trustee will need to determine and might have some challenges, perhaps, depending on what sort of insurances they have in place. Although, if it's something that you can self-insure but you can't externally insure, then I presume it is in members' best interest to have self-insurance rather than no insurance. But whether you have self-insurance rather than external insurance will be something a trustee has to take a view on. In the draft operating standards that came out a few weeks, maybe it was a month ago as well, there was details on or proposals on removing self-insurance and the ability to have a transition plan to have self-insurance removed within a 3-year period. The prudential standard says that it must be a contingency plan. I guess even for defined benefit interests where you're allowed to continue to self-insure, but if you decide it's no longer appropriate to insure, or the trustee decides that to have a plan in place to move to external insurance. And of course, there is a separate prudential standard that does deal with insurance and superannuation, SPS 250. So overall, we think SPS, the final prudential standard, was a good outcome. Okay, so perhaps a little biased because most of our recommendations were taken up, but we think they were sensible recommendations and they got a good hearing, so we're pretty pleased. There's still a few issues that we need to take up, probably through the prudential practice guide regime or perhaps otherwise, but around the issue of shortfall limits and some of the points that I alluded to earlier around the APRA approval process for restoration periods and how frequently that might need to be sought. We had suggested some greater powers on the trustee to restrict benefit payments in an unsatisfactory financial position, but that wasn't taken up, so we need to think a bit more. Are there really some deep issues around that we need to continue to take forward? And I guess we're also a little bit not disappointed because we knew this was the approach, but it was our belief that, as you know, currently the regime deals with the concept of technical insolvency, and that's all an assessment of minimum requisite benefits versus assets. And with this new focus on vested benefits and shortfall limit, we thought that this was somewhat of a double up, a potential source of confusion, and we should scrap the technical insolvency MRB type issue, a type of measurement of solvency, and just go with the shortfall limit. But that's a bigger change than it sounds, because the insolvency regime is already in SIS regulations and the like, and it was left unchanged. So we basically still have this two-pronged attack where technical insolvency measured against minimum requisite benefits. The restoration plan in SIS is for that to be addressed over a five-year period, whereas, of course, in the Prudential Standard, we need to address any unsatisfactory financial position relative to vested benefits within 3 years. And given that vested benefits are equal to or bigger than your minimum requisite benefit, if you've addressed the the vested benefit issue, then by default you've already addressed the MRB issue over a shorter time period. So we think that's probably a little bit unnecessary, but maybe that's just something to be addressed in the future, and it doesn't really change the focus of what's in SPS 160. Okay. Can I ask it any questions on SPS 160?
Brad, on the self-insurance one, where bigger funds are winding up and are going to transfer into another fund, sure, they can arrange some insurance, but quite often they've got people who are insured above an AAL and won't get insured and all that sort of stuff. Has APRA given any indication of how they're going to deal with, the uninsurable people in self-insured funds?
Yeah. Right, it's something that is still under discussion. We had a meeting with APRA actually just a week and a bit ago, still on the self-insurance issues. So I can say it's still a work in progress. They're exactly the sort of things that we raise. What about some people might have an approach or some funds of self-insuring the amount over an AAL, or, providing insurance for all members, but the insured policy has an exclusion on back claims or something like that, and so there's an element of self-insurance. How are these issues going to be dealt with? And I think it's fair to say that the issues that we're raising hadn't been thought through so much, really. I guess a lot of the more trickier issues haven't been addressed yet, so they are still things that we're in dialogue with APRA about, and we're actually putting in a submission, dealing with some of these insurance issues post a conversation we had with them, I think, Thursday, week ago. So, and if you've got any particular ones that you've got examples of that you need to be addressed, please feel free to shoot them through, and I'll make sure that they're either included in or covered, in the right generic kind of way in the submission we put in. But we're trying to identify issues like that.
Ashley Pomfayon here. Just a question on the shortfall limit.
Mm-hmm.
In this assessment by the trustee or potentially the actuary that the shortfall restoration plan is adequate, do you think that'll require either the trustee or the actuary giving an opinion on the strength of the employer to be able to financially pay the contributions or be willing to do it?
Yeah. The requirement for the actuary to take into account the employer covenant in a couple of places, like in the actuarial evaluation, was removed from initial proposals, but it's still, expected to be taken into account in just the actuary providing reasonable advice without it being a formal requirement that was initially proposed. So taking into account that is something that we think we will need to address, maybe perhaps through our own guidance, but it's not a formal part of the standard. It might, I shouldn't preempt what might be in a Prudential practice guide yet that we haven't seen. So.
Do you think that might leave an actuary exposed, though, in an extreme event of an insolvency?
Yeah. Which is why we didn't want them in the Prudential Standards for it to be a specific requirement, because we were concerned about that. And basically, it's the trustee's decision in a lot of these areas. In some of the initial Prudential Standards, I can't specifically say exactly what areas, but it seems like it was the actuary making the decision rather than the trustee, and we had that reversed in a number of areas throughout this Prudential Standard, that it's clearly the trustee's role, and we're the advisor to the trustee, but we're not the decision maker in a couple of points. So we were mindful of that.
Brad, I've got a question. Do you think
it's an easy one?
Yeah, will be. Do you think that you're talking about the trustee having to make the decision around whether self-insurance is in the member's best interest? Do you think there's scope for the actuary to? How will the actuary be able to help them with that sort of decision making?
I guess
is that something we want to get into?
Well, I think the trustee will turn to us, so we need to be in a position to respond. And then we'll have to take, I guess, exercise our judgment. That might be an issue depending on how that insurance is financed. It might be financed by the employer, in a DB arrangement, more than likely. So maybe it's something we need the trustee to guide the trustee on, or suggest the trustee needs to take into account in making its assessment that self-insurance is still okay. The strength of the reserves, how they're invested are things I'm sure that we'll be providing advice on. But I think it's inevitable that they'll look to us, so we've just got to be... It's more than just professional advice, I guess, because asking your opinion, so we've got to be a bit careful there too, so I dare say that's one we'll think about more from a guidance perspective.
Hey, John Bayliss. Both of those points, the shortfall limit and the self-insurance, sound like risk appetite decisions to me. Is there any link to the risk appetite standard?
I don't think there's a specific link in this standard, but we have to be conscious of all of the standards, I guess, in providing our advice. And I mean, the risk appetite is for the trustee to decide. So, again, we're relying on the trustee to then to, I guess, come to us if they need some opinion on this. Now, I'm sure risk in their risk management framework and the list of all their risks, if they're self-insured, that'll clearly be one of them. So they'll have an appetite associated with that risk, and if it's self-insurance, I think it would be material enough to be one that they need to have an appetite for, rather than just, I mean, the way I envisage they will work is that you might have in your risk register, 150 risks, but you'll have 20 or 30 key risks that you need to express as a trustee an appetite on, and self-insurance to me would be clearly one of them because of the risk associated with it. So I expect we'll be working with the trustee. The trustee must look to us, I think, in that case, in determining their mitigation strategy. I mean, if they're self-insuring, are we helping them with catastrophe insurance, stop-loss insurance, or what sort of reserving they need to put in place in order to make that, I guess, that statement as to what their tolerance is for, or their appetite is for self-insurance, for risk associated with self-insurance. It'll be a bigger issue than just if they're externally insuring. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, I'm looking at my stopwatch. I'll just quickly cover SPS 520 and 521 because we didn't actually put in the submissions, well, not in the one that I was involved in on these two points, but they do refer to actuaries, so we thought it was appropriate just to mention them today. So just a slide on each because they're, again, issues that I think we need to think a bit more about, and there might be issues that you think about in your current roles that we need to take into account. See, the term, there's actually a new term, RSE actuary, which wasn't actually in the initial standards. So there's a new term, RSE actuary, okay? So it's the figure of the appointed actuary type concept for a super fund. The concept of a responsible officer is now really expanded to be a responsible person. And so a responsible officer used to be typically, the trustee, the secretary, the senior management. Responsible person brings into that net the actuary and the auditor, among potentially other service providers, particularly, I'm only worried about the actuary and the auditor. So as the actuary is now a responsible person, it's captured by this net. So it means that the implications are that the actuary must meet the fit and proper requirements, and it's also that it's subject to the conflicts management prudential standard that I'll talk about in a second. So as fit and proper requirements, there are general requirements about that a trustee has to make an assessment of this responsible person, competence, character, diligence, experience, honesty, and integrity. So things that I'm sure we're all well equipped to handle. But of course, you must not be disqualified, which means you shouldn't be. You've never been convicted of an offence involving dishonesty, like it already exists for current trustees, and not be bankrupt and the like. The trustee has to make an assessment of your educational and technical qualifications and ensure that you have no conflicts, or either, if there are potentially conflicts, then they won't create a material risk. So they're sort of some of the general requirements that apply to responsible persons. Specific ones for actuaries include being an FIAA or an accredited member, ordinary resident in Australia, 5 years relevant experience. And this is one we looked at with interest, because it says, does say 5 years relevant experience that the trustee has to make an assessment. It doesn't say 5 years experience post-qualification as an FIA. So I guess I'm pretty much hoping that wasn't an error in the standards, and that is exactly what it means, because I think it's appropriate. When we've had lots of people who may spend 10 years and have fantastic experience qualify, they shouldn't have to wait 5 years before they can sign an evaluation report. And that's not what it says anyway, so we were comfortable with that drafting. So the trustee has to make an assessment of its actuary now, just as it had to do of its own directors or its secretary or the like. Must make it on appointment and annually. This starts from 1 July next year, and has to notify APRA if there are any changes. So as an actuary, you can expect your trustees to be asking you a number of questions over the next 6 months. We've already had one fund start to ask our actuaries, I don't know if anybody else is in the room that's the same, these questions. So they're making that assessment, starting it right now. Well, they kicked off their process. In conflicts of interest, again, trustee, of course, under this policy of this prudential standard, has to have a conflicts management policy. Deals with the roles and actions and assessment and monitoring to avoid conflicts. Regular and thorough inquiry of its service providers, and as I mentioned, now applies to the RSE actuary, because the RSE actuary is a responsible person to that superannuation fund. One of the things that applies to everybody, all responsible people, is that there is going to be a register of relevant duties and a register of relevant interests, or they may be combined into the same relevant register. And that's supposed to detail any significant influences on the responsible person's capacity to act in members' best interests. So this is another thing that the trustees will need to make assessment of, and will now be involved in that assessment process, whereas that hasn't been the case in the past. At least that register isn't a public disclosure document, so not that I'm sure we have too much to hide. So with that, I might turn over to Ben, unless there's any particular questions on this. Yeah? You got the phone?
Hi. Just on the... Hi, Emma Brody from Russell. On the relevant experience bit, is there any definition of what relevant means? So, for example, if someone's come over from the UK, they may have been an actress for ages, but if they haven't been in Australia, do they still have to wait for...
You can take account of overseas experience. It is quite a broad... three lines long sort of sentence that gives the trustee some discretion to take into account, so I think that will be fine. Then we'll go on down the...
Sorry, Ray Murray again.
Yeah.
So does that mean where you're appointing a firm of actuaries, you're actually now going to have to identify the individual within the firm? And if the firm wants to change the actuary underneath, they're going to have to come back and engage you in that process? Is that the implication that you see?
I'd say yes, and I'd say that's potentially really what should be the case now, because the actuary should... most trustees I've come across as an individual employment, even though it's typically the firm, but I think this clarifies that definitely should be the case going forward. You should be appointing a person.
And then on the conflict of interest, APRA has been on record for quite... well, Ravi out of APRA has been on record for quite some time as saying that he doesn't think the same actuary should work for employer and trustee. And the Institute... so I suppose I'm questioning, is that going to penetrate, you know, the next layer down? And then secondly, the Institute asked members to comment on that, and where's the Institute in their consideration of that?
I'm not sure on that point, unless Melinda's going to answer that, because I'm not involved in that conflicts sort of debate. I know it is the SBC, but I'm just going to look at one of my other colleagues who spends more time on that than me, which... but back to your initial question, I think... right. I mean, there's nothing in this that prevents that occurring, but the trustee has to make an assessment.
Is APRA likely to, in the next prudential guidelines, institute that? Is that possible, or you don't know?
I don't know. That's not been mentioned to us at all, so we'll see. Was there another question?
No.
Yep, down the back.
Rachel Pover, Ryan Hewitt. Just following on from the UK question, clearly.
Why?
As well as the experience, there was the ordinarily resident.
Yeah.
Now, we know that there's different definitions of resident from an immigration and a tax perspective. Is there a definition that's been given, or is it, in terms of temporary residency, permanent residency, citizenship, that kind of thing, is there anything given, or is it a trustee discretion?
It's the trustee to decide. The only guidance is the words in the prudential standard that says ordinarily resident. I don't know if there's a greater relevance you could attach to that that I don't know about. There might be in legal circles what the term ordinary resident means, because this applies to all responsible people, not just actuaries. So it applies to your trustees.
Yeah.
And I know one of my clients has a New Zealand-based trustee, so they're immediately actually thinking they now have to get that person to not be on the board because they're not ordinarily resident in Australia, and that's how they're reacting to that. But as to the technical meaning of the word ordinarily resident, it's not in the professional standards, and I just don't know if there's some... I mean, we should sort this out, I guess, but there may be some importance or relevance attached to that at law that I don't know about, but perhaps for tax purposes, whatever, what that term means.
Thanks.
So if there are no more questions, I'll ask Ben to cover the next three standards. Thanks.
Thank you, Brad, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to be going through three standards this afternoon. Operational risk reserves, or OFRA as I like to call them, and my clients actually find it quite amusing when I first say the OFRA standard and they think I'm saying the awful standard. Risk management, and then investment governance. Now, the approach I'm going to take to these particular standards is I'm going to go through an overview of what the standard actually covers, what the Institute's response to the standard was, and APRA's response to that, and then finally some challenges in relation to each of these standards where, for instance, trustees are having difficulty in relation to that particular standard, or where it's unclear, for instance, how APRA might respond to particular elements. And that third slide of each of these sections in particular, I'd be really keen to get some comment about how you are dealing with your clients in this particular area, these are unclear areas, and also if you've heard any feedback from APRA or elsewhere on how these unclear areas might actually apply. So first of all, OFR, and what does that actually mean? Operational risk financial requirement is a level of capital that's required to be held within the trustee or within a fund underneath the trustee to cover operational risks. Now, it needs to be sufficient to cover the operational risks that have been identified in the trustee's risk register and also unknown risks as well. And another complexity around that is it's also there to cover timing circumstances, for instance, whereby ordinarily the loss would be covered by a service provider, professional indemnity insurance, for instance, but in the meantime, before that recovery is actually received, the trustee could make out that payment, cover the losses to members, and then receive recovery later on. The trustees have to set an offer strategy. And actually, with each of these three particular standards that I'm going through, the standards apply generally from 1st of July 2013, but there's a lot of urgency around this because each of these standards require documentation, policies, strategies that need to go in with the MySuper application, which most trustees, in my experience, are looking around about the February or early March period next year at the latest. So a lot of this needs to be done fairly quickly. The OFRA strategy needs to set out factors such as how the trustee has come up with the particular level of a reserve or capital that they're setting. And whilst APRA has threw out the 25 basis points initially, and it's still in the FAQs as far as I'm aware, APRA sort of backed away from this and said that the trustees actually need to justify what the level of reserve is that's going to be held. How that reserve will be invested, process for calling upon that reserve, including authorisation levels within the trustee, process for implementing a replenishment plan if a tolerance level is breached. Now, a tolerance level is a proportion of the target offer. So let's say it's 90%, 80%, 70%, whatever it might be. Once the level of assets fall below that tolerance level, the trustee has to put in place a plan to replenish that back to the target within a reasonable period of time. Now, implementation initially, reserves need to be built within a three-year period. Now, we've got a number of trustees who have the appropriate amount of assets already, and so they're just going to throw that in straight away. In other cases, trustees might not have reserves, so they're going to have to build up these reserves within a three-year period. And how do they actually do that? Do they pull that from investment returns? Do they pull that from fees? Do they have a parent organisation in which they can pull that money from as well? Now, some other matters around or for public offer funds, there's currently the requirement to hold net tangible assets. That's going to disappear and effectively be replaced by the offer. However, you might find that some funds, some trustees, in addition to being trustees of RSEs, are also trustees of REs. They're responsible entities as well under the ASIC definition, so non-superannuation investment trusts. They are actually still going to have, and in fact Corps Act is going to be changed, still going to have capital regs in relation to their RE responsibilities in addition to offer requirements in relation to their RSE responsibilities. Now, the reserve may be called on to cover operational risks. So I'm going to come back to that definition, in fact, because that's been clarified a little bit, and it's a little bit restrictive, in a sense, to be honest. So having a look at the suggestions that were put forward by the Institute in their submission, clarification regarding the interaction between multiple reserves. What if the trustee were to hold several reserves? And I'm working with a few, for instance, that might already have 50 basis points, 100 basis points of money sitting aside. They have to put, for argument's sake, 25 basis points into an offer. How do those two reserves now interact, given that one is a restricted use and one is a non-restricted use? Clarity of the op-risk definition, I'll come back to that. With a strategy to explicitly include a requirement around how the unfettered access requirement will be managed in times of stress, because the requirement for the offer amount is that the trustee have free and unfettered access to capital. So if we've got times of investment stress, for instance, how will that actually be impacted? And two items in relation to the upcoming prudential practice guides, where the Institute has made suggestion around financial condition reports, for instance, would be quite useful in the board reporting of how the adequacy of reserves, how appropriate the reserves actually are working into the future, and also projections around and scenarios around replenishment plans. Because, to be quite honest, a lot of trustees are really not on top of the true risk management around offer, how sustainable their offer will actually be going into the future. So these are particular suggestions that could go into the prudential practice guides rather than into the standard itself. Now, in this particular standard, as well as the next two, there actually wasn't a great deal changed in the standards when the revised standards came out on 15 November. One of the amendments that was made in the offer standard was clarifying that the offer may actually be reduced at certain times. The initial standard set out that the offer may only be used to meet operational losses. What happens if, for instance, the fund were to halve in size? Or what happens if, for instance, the trustee were to reassess their offer and find out that it's too large? Well, the new standards clarified that it can actually be reduced in those sort of circumstances. And another one was around, which I didn't put in here, was the clarity of the op risk definition. And unfortunately, it became a little bit more restrictive. And that op risk definition now says that operational risks must be in relation to a risk that has materialised and has caused a loss to members or the deprivation of a gain to members. And the FAQs specifically say, give an example, for instance, of unit pricing, and say that in relation to a unit pricing error, there is the potential loss to members, and there's also the organisation that has to rectify the root cause. And there's a specific example that the rectification of the root cause does not come under the offer. So there's a restricted access in relation to how this capital is used. And this relates to, I suppose, the Institute's submission around clarity regarding the interaction between multiple reserves and an overall holistic approach to risk management. We've got more than just this small level of risks. So some of the key challenges, and fortunately in this standard and the next two, some of these key challenges are areas where actuaries can really help. First of all, the determination of the offer amount. Does the trustee use modelling? Do they use scenario approaches? Do they use a rough rule of thumb that they broadly justify in some manner? And if they're using modelling, for instance, where's the data going to come from to do that sort of modelling? Now, I'm coming across trustees that are, I suppose I would put into three buckets. Some which say, look, we have no idea what we're doing. Please, can you go away? Can you do us a model and come back with a figure? I've got some others that are saying, look, we don't think this is particularly complex. We'll put together a figure ourselves. And we've got some others, particularly in the retail sense, that are linked to banks, that this is all going to be linked through to their economic capitaling approach and in a credibly detailed way. And that's an incredibly interesting area for actuaries to be getting into. Now, how to link the offer to the risk appetite? So the risk appetite of the organisation, the trustee, in the past is generally, well, if they even had a risk appetite, has generally not touched on their appetite in relation to operational risks. So how will that risk appetite be linked through to their setting of the target offer? How will that risk appetite be linked through to the setting of the tolerance level, for instance? Another challenge that I'm seeing trustees is actually coming up with a figure near 25 basis points with such a narrow definition of operational risks. That is a really tough one. And when we're talking about risk appetite, you generally have to go a very long way up the confidence interval scale to get an offer that reaches the 25 basis points, which might be where a trustee wants to go, but obviously. Now, also, we're finding some expectations from APRA are fairly unclear. For instance, the 25 basis points that's thrown about. But we've got a lot of variation from one trustee to the next. Trustees that outsource everything, trustees that insource everything, trustees that have large insurance, small insurance, complex DB operations, multiple funds, simple DC operations. Why should they all have a reserve somewhere around the 25 basis points? Now, what this is coming back to is some justification around the reserve that the trustee actually comes up with. Expectations around the tolerance level and also around the definition, deprivation of a gain. What does that actually mean? Does it mean that if you take costs out of money that would otherwise go into unit pricing, is that a deprivation of a gain? I don't know. It's a little bit unclear. So is there any areas in which any individuals have had some work with clients in relation to offer, had some discussions with APRA, for instance, that might clarify some of these areas that I've thrown up here? Be interested to hear. Just as unclear. Risk management. Key areas of risk management is that trustees now have to have in place a risk management framework. In the past, we had a risk management strategy and a risk management plan. We now set out a risk management framework which covers, in effect, the holistic framework around the trustee's approach to risk management. It has to include a risk appetite statement, include the risk management strategy, and the risk registers, for instance, that we've all probably been working with in the past would generally come under the risk management strategy. And apologies, I've got a wrong word there, dedicated risk management function. That word was actually taken out and replaced with designated risk management function to, in effect, recognise that particularly smaller trustees, they wouldn't have one person working purely on a risk management function. They could work on other things as well. The trustee's business plan has to be aligned to the risk management framework. And initially, the standard had a rolling three-year business plan with annual reviews. That's been changed to a between 1 and 5 year rolling plan with annual reviews. Risk appetite statement. Now, I'm going to come back to that because that's one of the key challenges. The trustee has to have a risk appetite statement which sets out the degree of risk they're willing to accept and their risk tolerances in relation to risks. As I say, I'll come back to that. And the risk management strategy, which I won't go through in detail, because largely that's the combination of the RMS-RMP that has been in place for a number of years now. Now, the main submission the Institute put in relation to risk management was relating this to the concept of ICAP in the insurance area, and the life insurance and general insurance area, which works on a holistic nature of risk management. It links in the risks with the overall finances and resources of the capital of the entity, the insurer in this particular case. In superannuation, we don't really have, under the standard, that holistic approach. We've got an assessment of the risks, which is all well and good. We've got a little bit of capital in relation to ORFA, which is all well and good. What about all the rest? What about capital in relation to an overall risk management function? And so there was a suggestion that in the future there be consideration of an ICAP type approach to superannuation. And I know I've been speaking with actuaries within the insurance field, and a lot of them seem to think that ORFA is ICAP for super. It's not. It's only a very small part. APRA's response to various submissions, I mentioned the change in the business plan. Another one was that a lot of submissions suggested stress testing in place of risk tolerances in relation to the risk appetite statement. APRA came back and said, look, no, we don't think that's appropriate. Well, we're not saying that stress testing is not appropriate, but risk tolerances are an effective way of monitoring the risks and monitoring the progress of the plan in relation to the trustee's risk appetite. So risk tolerances have stayed in. Now, one of the key challenges that I'm seeing is the articulation of risk appetite. This is a very new concept to many trustees, and how do they actually go about doing that? A lot of trustees are having difficulty. There's been some guidance from APRA, particularly around the life insurance space, not a lot in relation to superannuation. But the key element of that is it's around the trustee actually quantifying in some way their appetite to risk in particular areas, and they should be pulling out the different categories of risk that apply in their risk register and quantifying their risk appetite in that way. The tolerance levels is another area that trustees are having difficulty, but I actually see that as a particularly valuable exercise for trustees in going through their material risks and actually coming up with tolerance levels whereby if their risks are starting to get above that tolerance level, that's an indication that their risk management function may actually not be working as well as it should be. Establishing the risk management function is difficult for smaller trustees. They may not have the resources in-house, and the cost of outsourcing could be too high for them. And I've mentioned about supporting capital, considering risk in a holistic manner. We've got the op-risk reserve, but that's only a very small component of risk. Well, I shouldn't say it's a very small. Op-risks are obviously a large area for superannuation trustees, but we're only looking at a subset of operational risks. What about all the other risks that trustees face, and thinking about capital in that holistic manner? And finally, investment governance. Investment governance is effectively about, governance of investments. It's about setting out a framework, a strategy for the different investment options, setting out the trustee's approach to liquidity management as well. Largely come from the period during the GFC, whereby a lot of investments, not only in superannuation funds, didn't perform the way the investors or the trustees actually expected them to. So one of the key elements of the investment governance framework is before trustees put in place investment strategies, actually stress testing those strategies and understanding how they will perform in different market environments so they can understand if another GFC were to happen, what would be the impact upon their investments. So the investment strategy has to be set out, there has to be an investment strategy for the overall fund and for each individual investment option as well. And one thing that's not clear out of that, and there has been submissions on this, is around what about trustees that have a large number of investment options? Setting an investment strategy for every single one is going to be quite difficult. And as I understand, the Prudential Practice Guides is going to set out some guidance around that, particularly for trustees that operate platforms, for instance. The strategy in particular has got to set out, and this is one of the key areas, how the strategy has regard to the new SIS section 52.6, which is essentially setting out risk and return, setting out diversification, liquidity, valuation information, and importantly, how the trustee has regard to after-tax outcomes and after-cost outcomes. So this is having the trustee really looking at net of tax, net of cost outcomes. And importantly, stress testing that I mentioned before. And stress testing also applies to liquidity, how the trustee is going to manage liquidity under stress scenarios. The submission from the Institute supported stress testing in particular and suggested that the PPG in particular make reference to the Institute's guidelines in this particular area. And as Brad mentioned, the PPGs are expected to be coming out very soon, maybe this week, maybe next week. And also suggesting that a liquidity event should constitute the fund being in an unsatisfactory financial position in relation to suspension of a trustee or investigation by the regulator. Now, the APRA actually didn't sort of come back on any of these suggestions, I'm afraid, and not much was changed in relation to the investment governance standard at all. So some of the key challenges that relate to investment governance that is still out there. Investment reporting measures are a significant additional work for funds with a large number of choice, because we're reporting on both risk and return measures. Now the strategy needs to include both risk and return measures. So it's getting quite complex. And what about those funds that have 20, 30, 100, 200 investment options when I'm talking about platforms, for instance? Another particular challenge is around the monitoring of investments and the individual that's responsible for monitoring being operationally independent from those actually implementing investments. That's a bit like the risk management function, could be a bit of a struggle for small trustees. And finally, APRA's confirmed that it's appropriate for trustees to establish a policy for managing the asset allocation, but they've removed the words rebalancing from that strategy. It was sort of implied in the standard that the trustee had to have a rebalancing policy, but nowadays trustees are starting to think more about dynamic asset allocation rather than strategic asset allocation. So they may not have a specific rebalancing policy. So we're looking at a policy for managing the asset allocation within defined ranges, but not necessarily under a rebalancing approach. So happy to take any further questions around challenges that anyone is seeing from their trustees in these particular areas.
John Newman. Ben, could you just say a few more words about the definition of operational risk? You made the comment that the ORFR can only be held for very specific risks and particularly not the cost of mitigation.
Yes.
What else has been said about what an operational risk actually constitutes and particularly what isn't an op risk?
That's one of the unclear levels, and I, to be honest, haven't heard a lot said about this. But the original definition, which is still in there, is a failure of internal controls, people, policies, and that's the same definition that's in banking and life insurance as well. But there was the additional paragraphs that were put into the revised standard, which said that an operational risk must have come from a risk that has materialised, so obviously not something that you think might materialise, and that has to have resulted in a loss to members, a member or members, of course, or a deprivation of a gain that such members would otherwise have received in relation to their benefits. And the FAQs gave the example of the unit pricing error, and said that a unit pricing error could affect, there could be a cost to the trustee in relation to the loss to members, and the other area could be rectification of the root cause. And the FAQ specifically said that the rectification of the root cause is not covered by ORFR. So the trustee is going to need to find money from elsewhere to cover that rectification. Now, there's a third area that sprung to my mind in that particular example. What about, for instance, the cost of the trustee communicating to members, sending out letters and all those sorts of things? That's not a loss to members, and it's also not correcting the root cause. So that actually didn't come under that example, and I'm not sure what the expectations will be around that particular area. Having said that, when you sort of what that's doing by narrowing the definition, it's making it more difficult for trustees to reach the 25 basis points because it's narrowing it down. And so when trustees are coming up with their actual reserve, what effectively they're doing in order to come up with the reserve that they think is appropriate is going to be accepted, they're effectively just shuffling up the confidence interval scale in order to reach something that would be expected of them by APRA. Because on that basis point area, I have heard some secondhand comments that for smaller funds, APRA is actually looking closer to the 30 basis point level because of the uncertainty of the risks in relation to smaller funds. I do know that for larger funds, and I'm talking about retails that have detailed modelling, detailed data, can use external data and so on, they might be more able to actually justify something different, I would have thought.
Ben, Melinda Howes, did I hear you correctly saying the risk must have materialised?
Yes.
So you have to have had a unit pricing error before you can hold a unit pricing error reserve?
No, before you can use the reserve to pay for something.
Oh, thank you.
So you can't pull out some money out of your reserve
and
say, I'm pulling it out because I think I'm going to have this cost coming up soon.
Okay, all right, that makes more sense.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Well, just to say thank you for coming along. To encourage you to think about any other questions that you may think about now that you've heard Ben and my presentation, or you've had a chance to go and spend some time reading the standards, because we are willing, looking for feedback, of course, because that might help in any of our further discussions with that, because there will be more. So I'd encourage you to do so. So please send them.
Well, thank you very much. Please join me in thanking both Brad and Ben for a very interesting presentation. It's great to see so many people here for a superannuation topic. We've got a superannuation practicing president next year, John Newman, here, so it's great for super actuaries. You can't get away without a quick plug from the sponsors at something like this. I just wanted to let you know the dates have come out for the Actuary Summit next year, which is what we're now calling the biennial convention, 20th and 21st of May. It's here in Sydney. And for anyone that is having a good budget year, you can actually prepay for that before the end of the year and pre-register. So great to see you all here. I hope you have a happy Christmas and a great new year, and we'll see you back in 2013. Thanks for coming today.